This podcast is recorded on stolen and unceded Aboriginal land.
We acknowledge the First Nations and elders of this country and join their calls for justice. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
The rise and rise of the Greens. They are not bystanders. They are not harmless. They are not quirky environmentalists. They are a calculated political machine that already has tremendous influence on our society. Time for the truth about this toxic political party to be exposed.
Stop. Stop calling me a calculated political machine.
I'm blushing. We're blushing a bit.
I hate it when you say that I'm winning. I sure hope you don't share any evidence of my success over the last, 40 years.
This is a beautiful graphic from our good friends at Advance Australia, which lays out how the Greens have grown from one MP to 40 MPs in just 40 years. It's a really lovely graphic. Again, they're using the logo. This, if you take away the Advance logo in the corner, like, again.
Greens designers shaking in their boots right now.
We could totally use this. And they lay out that we had one MP in Tasmania in 1983 and that has grown to 40 MPs across the country, both state and territory and federal, in 2023. And as our dear friend Ellen Sandel, the new leader of the Victorian Greens, pointed out, that if you factor in 2024, it's actually even worse than that. What are we sitting on now? We're actually on 47 MPs.
Although she did, she adjusted a bunch up, I think, in Victoria and Tasmania, but then one was adjusted down. I'd have to look at it. Is it like for Lydia Thorpe leaving the party potentially?
I guess technically.
Quietly that they actually got that wrong. Right. But yeah, it's even more dire. I guess you could almost say the Greens are a real serious danger.
What do you think is the truth about this party that they're trying to get out?
Well, you thought that they were like preparing for a big expose or something, that's what they mean by exposing the toxic truth. Whereas my take, I think they're literally just saying the toxic truth is that they're not just quirky environmentalists, which is how I identify personally, but that we're not just that and that we are a serious political force. Like, that's the dark truth.
Time for the truth about this toxic political party to be exposed. Okay, are you going to do that? What are you going to do?
I think that's what they think they've done.
Just with this
like,
graphic?
You thought they just had one MP and it was Bob Brown and you blinked for a second, but that's not true anymore.
We here at Advance Australia have gone to Wikipedia and we've exposed the truth.
Yeah, that's right. Investigative journalism at its best.
Well, Advance Australia, please do not keep posting all this information about how we're growing and we're speaking to people and we're an incredible, powerful political force that's fighting for the climate and fighting for economic justice. Please stop doing that. Please.
I mean, between this and the cool video of Adam Bant, like, you've got to wonder if they've got we've got a plant in Advance Australia. Some young little like Greens intern pretending to be a young Lib. Who knows?
Hell yeah, dude.
But let's talk about the Greens, because we love to do that on this show and just check in on their level of delusion.
We're stuck with the hosts of Chapo Shithouse podcast.
This is a serious danger to Australia.
Well, toxic truth exposed. This is Serious Danger, a podcast about green politics in Australia. It is not an official Greens Party podcast. Go to Advance Australia for that kind of thing. It's made possible with the help of the Green Institute. Thanks to the Green Institute. And produced by Michael the Griff Griffin. I'm Tom Ballard. I'm on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung people in the Kulin Nation. Hello, everyone.
Hello, I'm Emerald. I'm in Mansion on Yuggera and Turrbal country.
What are we doing this week, Emerald?
This week, we are looking at the latest developments for Palestine. So the ICC arrest warrants or applications for arrest warrants and a few more states moving to recognize Palestinian statehood. A little bit more, and we kind of and then we're going to delve into the thorny but legitimate questions surrounding the current migration debate in Australia, a conversation you have long been wanting to have, Tom, because you're racist.
That's correct.
Before we get into it, I just want to thank our new patrons, Liliana, Colin, Cara, Mitch, Karen, Gemma, Andrew, Milo, and Phoebe, all of whom will now have access to the chat with Trina Massey, our live show in Mianjin, Brisbane, that we put out on the Patreon, plus a back catalogue of so many episodes, so much good stuff. The chat with Jeff Sparrow and Sam Waldman about 12 Rules for Strife, their new little cartoon, book was much loved. The deep dive on Jim Penman, aka Jim for Jim's Mowing, and his eugenicism, it's cool stuff. Book reviews, etc., etc. It's all there, and it's only $3 a month, and it helps pay Mike and keep the show going. So we love you for doing it. Thanks.
Love you.
This issue is the final straw for me. Anthony Albanese is simply not up to being a national leader if he cannot take a position on a moral issue as fundamental as this. For his comment, I'm joined now by Foreign Editor for The Australian, Greg Sheridan.
Look, I think this is Albanese's worst moment as a Prime Minister. I got to tell you, I really like Albo as a person, you know, fellow Christian Brothers old boy, rugby league fanatic. I mean, he's got a lot of money in the bank with me, but I think this is, you know, just pathetic, just pathetic. The idea that you can't make a comment on an International Criminal Court case, for once in his life, stand up to the Greens.
For once in my life, I have someone who needs me, someone I've needed so long.
Alrighty, so bit of stuff happening in Gaza and on the Palestine front. As always, it continues. This week, I think the focus has really been around what's happening in the International Criminal Court. So on Monday, we got a statement from International Criminal Court prosecutor Karim Khan, who said that he was filing applications for arrest warrants for 5 people accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity. That included 3 senior Hamas leaders as well.
Oh, thank God. That's the end of it, right? Hamas are being held to account.
Stop. Sorry.
And they're the bad
Next
guys.
Segment.
And they're going to be taken care of. So that's at the end.
No, Tom, we've got false equivalences to make here
oh,
at the ICC. That's what we want to do. So Israeli President Netanyahu and also the Defense Minister were also included in these applications for arrest warrants.
Fuck.
Allegedly, they have done some very bad things. The alleged crimes by Hamas include murder, extermination, taking hostages, sexual violence and torture, as well as
bad.
A bunch of other things. Alleged crimes committed by Israel include starvation. Worth noting that under international law, apparently starvation includes depriving humans of things that they need beyond food, so like fuel, water, electricity, those sorts of things as well as food.
And medicine. So I guess all the
medicine,
like big pharma
things
companies in America should probably be taken before the ICC.
Yeah. but yeah, so starvation, murder, intentional attacks on civilians, extermination, and persecution, and other things.
Gosh, seems bad.
Yes, lots of people have many feelings about this statement from the
Triggered much?
International Criminal Court prosecutor. Do you have a react, Tom?
I say, go for it, mate. We should say this is an application for warrants. My understanding is the few experts I listened to are sort of saying it's probably unlikely that the applications will be rejected.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen too much. But yes, hey, what do you know? Once international law and in concepts of international justice are applied equally to people in the West or the Western allies, people get extremely hurt and get very worried. And my immediate reaction to the false equivalence, whenever I hear this false equivalence thing, I always sort of go, no, it isn't. You can't compare the two because Israel's killed shitloads more people.
Yeah. There's kind of, there's 2 ways to approach this main, like the general take from across the world, and particularly in the West, but also Hamas have criticized this decision from the ICC prosecutor as a false equivalence between Hamas and Israel. And both sides are saying, well, it's not fair to compare us to them because they're way worse. And first of all, it's like, well, that's not what this is. It's simply that the prosecutor has made a statement where he has announced that he is issuing these warrants and separately listed out the different crimes that each are accused of, not saying that they've both committed the same crimes at all. But also, on the flip side, it's like it's the reason I think that there are these accusations of a false equivalence or that people are so outraged is because we are used to not applying equal treatment to leaders in the West and their allies, as you
right.
point out. So there's a long list of reactions, but some of, a bit of flavor. For example, the Israeli defense minister, alleged war criminal, said that the prosecutor of the ICC had drawn a, quote, despicable parallel between Israel and Hamas, while Hamas demanded that they should cancel the arrest warrants against leaders of the Palestinian resistance. and denounced Mr. Khan, that's the ICC prosecutor's attempts, quote, to equate the victim with the executioner.
Jesus Christ.
Meanwhile, Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, is basically saying this is anti-Semitism.
Great.
Because everything is, apparently, says that the ICC prosecutor was, quote, one of the great anti-Semites in modern times. He said he was like the judges in Nazi Germany who denied Jews basic rights and enabled the Holocaust. What? His decision to seek arrest warrants against Israel's prime minister and the defense minister was, quote, callously pouring gasoline on the fires of anti-Semitism that are raging around the world.
Mm.
All right. Worth noting, of course, a few people point out that this was in a video that Netanyahu released in English, clearly designed, you know, it's designed to reach mostly the US, like people in English-speaking countries. Speaking of, US President Joe Biden has called the ICC decision, quote, outrageous.
Great.
And said there was, quote, no equivalence, none. Is that how he speaks? Is he so old? I don't know. Between Israel and Hamas.
Come on. There's no equivalence between Israel and Hamas. Come on.
You can't say that. It's outrageous. I mean, that's even apparently also in the US, the Republicans are like, that's not good enough. And these Republicans are moving a bill called the, quote, Illegitimate Court Counteraction Act.
Oh, my God.
That would block ICC officials' entry to the US, revoke any US visas they hold, and prohibit them from any property transactions in the country unless the court ceased cases against, quote, protected persons of the United States and its allies.
Cunt.
Which is just the most insane. Like, it's just so funny to be like, if you try and say that I'm breaking the law, like, if you charge me for crimes, you shouldn't be able to do that because I don't like it.
The moments of it, yeah, of being just absolute mask off stuff. I think Lindsey Graham, the US senator, was like, hey, if you think the ICC's, you know, if we let the ICC get away with this, next thing they'll be coming for us. At which point, I believe some pro-Palestinian. Yes, some pro-Palestinian supporters like applauded in the room when he said that. Like, yeah, that sounds great, Lindsey.
Yeah.
Imagine what justice for? Applying to everybody equally through these institutions that we're told are the rules-based order of the world, right? This is how the world's supposed to run. And, of course, we celebrate and reward and endorse the decisions of the ICC when they, for example, issue an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin. But, hey, what do you know? When they turn around and apply the same standards to leaders that we like and back in and give billions of dollars in money and weapons aids to, that's wrong. That's naughty. That's bad. That's unfair.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, when you say mask off, it's right, because when people kind of drill down into what they're saying with the false equivalence argument, they're then forced to draw out what they think the differences are between, you know, an Arab-led resistance movement and a colonial power. UK PM Rishi Sunak said, quote, there is no moral equivalence between a democratic state exercising its lawful right to self-defense and the terrorist group Hamas. Like, it is just that classic, this is the distinction between the good, light, bright Israel and the dark, evil, animalistic.
It's like Tony Palestine. Abbott goodies and baddies shit, right? It's like, no, there have to be goodies and baddies in every conflict, and the ICC should just go after what we designate to be the baddies.
Yeah.
And that democracy thing, well, first of all, I mean, we know Israel isn't a true democracy. If you're operating a system of apartheid, you're not a true democracy. Plus, there's a whole bunch of dodgy shit happening within Israel and its institutions regardless. But just this idea of, like, they're a democracy. They can't do anything bad, guys.
Yeah, they're
Name
a democracy.
Name me one democracy, apart from, I don't know, maybe Nazi Germany or the United States of America, that has ever done anything bad.
Yeah. Read a history book, guys.
Come Hello. On.
They're a democracy. yes, lots of other European countries, however, are kind of backing in the ICC decision. You know, France and Belgium are broadly, these countries saying, like, we respect the jurisdiction of the ICC and their independence and their fight against impunity. Germany was like, yes, we support their independence, but also was like, by doing this statement where you put both warrants in the same thing, you have kind of that's resulted in the, quote, incorrect implication of equivalence, which, I mean, fuck Germany, but it's like, I don't know. Do you think there's an argument that they should have? Well, no, because you just know if the prosecutor issued a statement about warrants for Hamas for Israel, that would have been absolutely insane. Mm. Like, a lot of people would have rightly been angry, whereas if they did it just for Israel, Yeah, that either way, like it wouldn't have worked. So I feel like
your defense, you can't be like, hey, you've made everyone crazy with your decision here.
Yeah,
the critique should be people shouldn't be crazy in response to your decision. Yeah. You did the right, supposedly, unbiased, the thing that the law is supposed to do, dry, and justice is blind, and just supposed to follow these procedures, right? Let's say, for the sake of argument, that's what the ICC has done. Then people shouldn't react in their crazy way. That's the critique that should come from Germany. And I mean, yeah, Germany is so interesting because Germany is a signatory to the Rome Statute.
Mm.
But Germany has, gone through this insane, there's lots written and discussed this about the way that German society and politics is approaching the current conflict in Gaza. It just sort of wall-to-wall, flat-out unqualified support for Israel and the persecution and prosecution of anyone who says anything vaguely pro-Palestinian. It's like quite a bizarre culture in that respect. But they're a signatory of the Rome Statute. So if Netanyahu was to travel to Germany, in theory, under the obligations under that statute, they would have to take him in.
Well, yes, in theory, in Australia too. So maybe just quickly we can touch on what this means. So as you said, the application for arrest warrants means they haven't been issued yet. They need to be reviewed and approved by a pretrial chamber of the court before they'll be issued. But it's likely that, it's unlikely that they won't be. If they are then issued, ICC members, so members of the International Criminal Court, will be obliged to cooperate with the decisions and obliged to detain these people if they come across them in their area. If they're in the area, they're like, oi, isn't that? Isn't that? Can someone grab Netanyahu? That's Netanyahu.
That's Netanyahu over there.
Isn't that the guy from the ICC? Isn't that the one?
You, sir, stop. This is a citizen's arrest.
Yeah. So, if one of these people goes to one of those states, they could be arrested. Australia is a member, but the US, like other states like the US and Israel, of course, aren't members of the ICC. They say they don't recognize its jurisdiction, and the ICC can't impose itself, its jurisdiction on non-member states without consent. But the thing is, the ICC does recognize Palestine. So Palestine is a member of the ICC. That is because Palestine, like, to get there, went through the UN. I guess there is a link between the UN because Palestine had to become an observer state of the UN.
Yeah.
In, I think that was 2012, they had initially tried and failed. They tried again. Australia abstained on the second vote, by the way, but they were successful in becoming an observer state. That then gave them the right to sign the Rome Statute, which then gave them the right to be a member of the ICC.
Right.
So that means that the ICC does have jurisdiction over Palestinian territories. They formally decided that in 2021, actually. They made that decision that, yes, we have jurisdiction over Palestinian territories, including Gaza. But of course, I mean, Israel disputes that. The US also disputes the authority of the ICC. Russia and China are also not members of the ICC. But, the ICC has said, well, we call on even non-member states to please cooperate with us in the spirit of, I don't know, not supporting war crimes.
Yes, not doing crimes would be great. I mean, a truly evil press conference from a guy, I think he's from the State Department or like the White House, one of the press officers of, I think, from the State Department, being asked by a journalist, like, okay, if Palestinians want any redress at all, where should they go to? And they say, well, the ICC doesn't have jurisdiction because there's no Palestinian state. Okay, it's like, okay, so what are their options? And he's literally like, Israeli courts have a process. They can apply to Israeli courts to sort things out, or they could talk to us, America. It's like, fuck you, dude, right. You evil demon. What the hell are you talking about?
Truly demon-like responses. And then from Australia, kind of nothing.
What?
Unclear. So initially, Albanese, when this news came out, told reporters, this is from The Guardian, that he would not comment on, quote, court processes globally to which Australia is not a party. I don't.
You are, like, a party. You are. We support the really. Court. What the fuck are you talking about?
I feel like maybe then later on, DFAT, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, needed to clarify. And yes. So they outlined the government's formal position. Their position is they note Khan, the prosecutor's request, and that Australia, quote, respects the ICC and the important role it has in upholding international law. This is so both sides.
Our official position is not my circus, not my monkeys.
Exactly. They also said there's no equivalence between Israel and Hamas. They just got all the lines. They renewed calls for immediate release of hostages.
Fantastic.
They added, quote, any country under attack by Hamas would defend itself. And I bet this is one of those situations where they wrote but and then someone deleted but and wrote and. Because they then say, and in defending itself, every country is bound by the same fundamental rules. Israel must comply with international humanitarian law.
Right. It must. And has it doing that, do we think? What do we have an opinion on that?
No with the, comment.
Anything to say to the tens of thousands of dead children in regards to on that position? Or are you just saying that, hey, if you are going to defend yourself, then you got to do it good. Jesus Christ.
I mean, cowards. I don't know if anyone, like, I guess that they could have acknowledged that the statement from the prosecutor outlines all of the work that they've done to gather significant evidence of these crimes being committed. Like, they could have acknowledged that, yes, there is evidence. They haven't done that. I do wonder, it's interesting, maybe going back to the comparison has been drawn, as you just drew, between this announcement and the reaction that it has garnered and the announcement from the ICC last year that it had issued arrest warrants for Vladimir Putin. The difference, I guess, in part, one of the differences is that that statement was made after the warrants had already been issued, which would have made it apparently harder for, like, it's a little bit trickier than, or what's the word, less acceptable for countries to criticize, like for member states to criticize the decision, whereas the statement being made before the warrants have actually been issued kind of almost opens it up to a bit more criticism. But the argument that the prosecutor has made as to why he did that is like, I just want, as like, this is happening right now, it's ongoing, and, you know, I'm urgently hoping maybe this will pressure these leaders to stop doing the things that they're doing. But yeah,
I don't think there will be any lick of difference between whether these issues, if the warrants are granted. I think you'll have exactly the same people saying exactly the same things with even increased outrage and apoplexy, because they just don't believe in equal justice for everyone and that everyone should be subject to the same international law.
Yes, they were not happy with when the ICC did this for Putin. It was all like, yes, absolutely. At the time, the DFAT talking points, which I think must have been FOI'd and released, included welcoming the decision and lines like, quote, the court's decision is an important step towards justice for Ukraine and its people. Imagine them saying, like, important step towards justice for Palestine. Anyway, or like even for the civilians of both Israel and Palestine, or Israel and Gaza, like either of that they could have said, but no. Russia must be held to account for its unlawful actions in Ukraine. Again, imagine saying Israel must be held to account for its unlawful actions.
Yeah, imagine.
Australia strongly supports the ICC's investigation into the situation in Ukraine. And also, I mean, keep in mind, this was like, you heard the list of, it is a long list of crimes that are alleged to have been planned and, what's the word, you know, carried out, implemented by Israel and Hamas leaders. The ICC arrest warrant was specifically even just for, well, not just, it's awful, but it was in relation to Russia forcibly deporting children from Ukraine territories to Russia. And yet, yeah, it's just easy for everyone to just be like, yep, we agree. Even, you know, Australia at least is, as we said, a member of the ICC, so it would make sense. We would be like, yes, we support it. But even Joe Biden at the time, US still not being a state, he did say, he's like, look, the ICC isn't recognized internationally by us. But he said, yeah, I think it's justified. I think it makes a very strong point. Like, he wasn't saying it's, quote, outrageous like he is now.
Sure. Of course not. Yes, and I mean, he has to give that caveat to say, hey, we're not signed up to this thing because we're fucking America, bro. Back off.
We don't need none of that.
We're not committing any crimes. Don't you worry about that.
We don't need anyone else telling us.
But even then. And it's just like, it's a classic. It's, you see states doing it, you see people in general discourse doing it, quoting a source when that source agrees with their position and justifies them, and completely ignoring them when they, you know, pursue an action or come up with a conclusion that contradicts them. Everyone's just looking out for themselves, man.
Yeah. Of course, I guess it does, like, I suppose it's unsurprising that the Australian government's position is fairly equivocal on this. I would even wonder, like, it's unclear whether they even support the ICC's jurisdiction over Gaza, because back in 2021, the Morrison government at the time, it opposed that decision because it emphatically rejected any recognition of Palestinian statehood. But right. Now we have the Albanese government kind of edging towards statehood while also saying, well, we're not doing that necessarily just yet. We're not sure. Like, it's clear that their position is far less settled. You know, obviously we had Penny Wong last month doing that speech where she was saying that, quote, a two-state solution is the only hope to break the endless cycle of violence. They have this framing that's like, well, yes, we would support Palestine purely because that's how you destroy Hamas. Like, they only say it in that sort of frame, but they are saying it. You know, Australia did support the UN vote to urge UN Security Council to consider, like, to favorably consider Palestine's application for full membership. Mm. But at the same time, when explaining that vote, they're like, this, to be clear, this isn't recognition of Palestinian statehood, but we no longer are saying that necessarily that recognition can only come after everything's been resolved.
Oh, boy.
What a brave
position.
Yeah. It's so Labor. It's so Labor government, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. You were saying, I mean, and I think even Penny Wong, yes, was kind of pushed into this question of Palestine and recognizing Palestinian statehood following that vote a little further and was even a little bit more emphatic, saying, you know, this isn't about Palestinian statehood. It's about, quote, modest additional rights to participate in United Nations forums, and saying Australia will only recognize Palestine, quote, when we think the time is right.
Oh, great. So thanks, oh, good. Penny. No, I think you should recognize it when the time's wrong, actually.
For us. Yeah, no.
What the hell are you talking about?
So brave.
You fought for the policy at your own fucking conference to call on a future Labor government to recognize the state of Palestine. Yeah. When you meant that, did you mean like in 2040 or did you mean in your next term of government, you weirdo?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I mean, the question of statehood is obviously the other thing that's kind of in the news this week in terms of Palestine. This week, Spain, Norway and Ireland all moved to recognize Palestine, which brings the total number of countries that do so to 143.
So many countries do this. So many countries recognize it.
We do not. We do not. Yeah, Sweden and the UK voted to do so after an Israeli bombardment of Gaza during in 2014. Yeah, I read an SBS article that kind of outlined the joining of or the recognition of Palestinian statehood by different countries over time. Like, a bunch joined in 1988 when the Palestinian Liberation Movement kind of announced itself and was like, "Yes, we are Palestine, and our capital is Jerusalem."
Mm.
And by the end of that year, 82 countries in total had recognized them. And then there was another lot in like 2010, 2011, mostly from South American countries. And then Sweden did it in 2014. Whereas, yeah, but the status of countries like US, Britain, Australia, other Western countries have all been saying, well, recognition can only come as part of a negotiated peace settlement. I guess the question is, like, do you think that moves like what, you know, Ireland and Spain and Norway have done this week, do you think that does make a difference? It's kind of a symbolic gesture, but does it carry
weight? Yeah, I mean, how to determine how much any such gesture weighs, or in the wacky world of international diplomacy, how is pressure built and the timelines are so long and, you know, it's certainly hard to say. Doesn't hurt, you know. You would hope that a country looking at the current situation, knowing the history of Israel's illegal occupation and the suffering of the Palestinian people and the way that their ability to live free, just lives is completely non-existent thanks to Israel's actions and the current makeup of the nation state of Israel as we know it. So more countries joining the fight. I was surprised Ireland hadn't already done this, to be honest, because the Irish quite famously pro-Palestinian. Yeah. What I think is interesting is, of course, people will say that recognizing the Palestinian statehood now would be a reward to all the terrorism and the violence that is happening. which I would just reverse. I'd say, okay, so not recognizing Palestine, that's not a reward to the mass killings and the genocidal war that Israel is unleashing now, and the decades and decades of illegal occupation that they've carried out, and the treatment of Palestinian people. Like, why do they get this reward of giving carte blanche, getting nuclear weapons, getting shitloads of military and political support for decades and decades, and they get rewarded by not having a state recognized, you know, a simple fact that anyone can see that Palestine exists and that people have a right to live there freely with their own self-determination.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fundamentally the right thing to do to recognize Palestine and all of the people, all the Palestinian civilians living in it and who identify as Palestinian. But I think learning more about this ICC case and how those processes work this week has made me also think of it in terms of the potentially tangible benefits that recognizing Palestinian statehood can have. That, you know, there are processes that depend on member bodies of certain international organizations recognizing statehood. And then that means that, for example, yes, that order can be implemented in that state or can be carried out in that jurisdiction. Like, if more countries recognizing statehood means that the people conducting war crimes in Palestine can be held to account and ideally stopped, then that's a pretty important outcome. I mean, but yeah, aside from the fact that, yes, Australia absolutely should recognize Palestine because it's the right thing to do, you know.
I think I put it in the line of things that chip away at this idea that was persisted for such a long time, which is, you cannot question Israel's actions or what Israel is doing, all right? So when you have leading human rights organizations, like one after the other, come out and say, no, what Israel is doing in occupied territories is tantamount to apartheid, like, all of it builds a level of pressure. Once you have more and more countries coming out and saying, of course, we recognize Palestine and stand in solidarity with them. I mean, it does, I think, over time build and does something to the debate and does something to the amount of commitment and the recognition that ordinary people and indeed who can eventually pressure politicians to actually do something and shift and recognize that the status quo is completely unacceptable and wrong. And yes, and to blast through this kind of two sides bullshit, which is kind of the constant fight around Israel-Palestine, right? This idea that there is an equivalence and they're just as bad as each other, or there's blame on both sides, ignoring the illegal occupation that one side is doing to the other.
Yeah, and it probably contributes to the, you know, the personhood, almost like the humanization or dehumanization of Palestinian people. Like, I think there is something about statehood and recognizing Palestine as a nation of people that makes it more difficult to do what Israel is trying to do, which is cast Palestinians as less than human and as animals. There's also, I guess, the only other little kind of update on the home front in terms of Palestine and Israel and Gaza this week was update on the student protests at universities. So the protesters at the University of Melbourne who have been camping out there have claimed a win and decided to disband their encampment after the university agreed to one of their key demands, which was disclosing ties to Israel. They said they've given the uni 1 month to disclose. They said they're still committed to their demands. They will continue to build and fight until the University of Melbourne, quote, not only discloses but divests in full.
Yes, although there was a bit of an update I heard on the radio just this morning I think the University of Melbourne, and perhaps this will be clearer or older news by the time people hear this, but they said the uni was like, yeah, we're posting that information on our website. And then the protesters were like, okay, we're going to stay here until you email out all staff and students with this information. Like, you actually proactively inform students and staff that this is exactly where the money and the relationships that the university has with the people doing apartheid and war crimes. So that's the latest I've heard. I don't know.
I mean, do you think they should they be staying until they divest? Like, is disclosure enough to warrant packing up?
I am loath to tell people who, how to do their shit. Like, I don't know the pressures on these folks. I mean, we know students have been threatened with expulsion. We know that there's probably some economic considerations that some of them are facing as well. I have a huge amount of respect and love for these folks, and I think it's very cool what they've done, and I think they've conducted themselves extraordinarily well and put up with a lot of shit, both physical violence and demonization in the press. So I'm not going to, even though I have a podcast, I'm not going to opine on that. What to do. I suppose it is, I guess disclosure of these relationships is not exactly the win that one would hope. And I guess I would be just interested to see where things would go. I think what would be more likely is that you would have violent expulsion of them from either police or security forces before a university would actually back down. But I think it's always good to push as much as possible because it's interesting. Like, how committed is this university to these relationships, and how much does it not want to do the right thing to the point where it will send in people with weapons to expel their own students from a physical space? That's an interesting question, I suppose.
Yeah. And it's still unclear to me. Like, I sort of didn't have time to do a whole lot of digging, tried to do a bit of digging on the status of the encampments at other universities. And it's kind of unclear to me where they're up to. Like, I know that there have also been threats, for example, at University of Queensland. Students have been threatened with disciplinary action for like chanting certain slogans. So they tried to ban, for example, the word intifada.
Incredible.
At UQ. I also know as well, and I don't know if this has been reported, but I have heard from people who were there at a protest this week that police were there pepper spraying protesters, which is pretty hectic. So I don't know if the encampment is ongoing or whether they're just kind of I know they're continuing actions. Certainly they're doing like teach-ins and rallies and things like that. I don't know whether the camp is there or not. And I honestly don't know what I would do if it were me, because I mean that's a real commitment to stay there camped out when it could threaten your degree, your financial security, your safety. Like if they're cops are fucking violent. So,
And so just to confirm, the free speech on campus crowd are where exactly?
Are they
down there lending support or no?
They must be. I mean, I assume. Don't know.
It's perfect. You could not get a clearer example of the bullshit of that entire cultural conversation than, universities are squashing free speech and these kids don't know anything. And then send in the cops and bash them in their heads. Yes.
Yeah.
And you can't say these words. You can't do this chant. You can't show certain signs. And what are you protesting about? Oh, against kids being killed in a genocide. No, that's too woke. So shut up, everyone.
No.
Fuck off.
Next up on Serious Danger, migrants. Do we need them?
That was good.
I'll be joined by my panel, Emerald Moon, Andrew Bolt, Chris Getty,
Peter
and
Pauline.
For a balanced perspective. All right. Yes, I've been wanting to have the chat for a little while because I think it's important. I think there is a very concerning and very complicated debate swirling around at the moment about Australia's migration levels, what it means for the housing crisis and xenophobia and the country, but then also is it legitimate to have a question about how many people should come to this country?
And the circumstances in which they come.
Damn it. Oh, this is it, folks. I'm getting cancelled. Here we go. But no, like the Labor government is making moves about this. Obviously, the coalition are going nuts with it and are using, blaming migrants for every single problem in our society. That's terrible and bad, and we'll get to that, obviously. But Labor is making moves to this, and I'm interested in what the Greens think about it. What's the correct leftist response? Because I would say that sometimes I see some commentators on the left who maybe get a little bit of a get-out-of-jail-free card or dismiss the complications of this debate by, making a worthy position saying that, hey, racism is bad and xenophobia is bad and migrants are welcome. So I'm interested in all the details of that. Am I making you nervous, Emerald?
A little bit.
Oh, God.
We'll see. I think I'm excited to find out the correct leftist take, which Tom has promised us, everyone.
You
just said.
I don't fucking know. What's been your experience debating this stuff around population and immigration within the Greens generally? What's been your general thoughts on these issues?
I don't know that I've had to have too many tricky conversations myself about this within the Greens. I think perhaps the more icky conversations I've had within the Greens are about population generally.
Right.
And that kind of, which I think we've discussed before, and an environmentalist idea that, we shouldn't have kids or something. which is interesting because, I think that debate is sometimes conflated with, and it is linked with, like, xenophobia, and because the question is, who gets to have kids? What's a worthy population to grow, and which population should be suppressed, et cetera, tend to get quite racist. But it seems to me that the Greens, like Greens membership, very broadly supports migration, perhaps even more than they support, population growth domestically. I don't know.
Interesting. So what does it mean to say you support migration in that you think migration is a good thing? So I guess I want to disentangle between, hey, I support migration and the question of, well, is there a numbers question? Are our migration levels too high, too low, et cetera? I mean, I guess I know it's extremely tricky and you need to be really careful about these conversations, and some people obviously do conduct these conversations and debates with no care whatsoever. Case in point, Peter Dutton. But surely it must be possible to have a meaningful, respectful conversation about Australia's migration levels without becoming racist and xenophobic. If we can if we can seriously have a chat about quantity and not quality, you know, that's a terrible term in response to human beings. But I mean, the makeup of that migration level, you can say our migration level should be non-discriminatory, absolutely 100%. Now can we have a conversation about exactly how many people are in as part of that program every year?
Yeah. Well, my question is, but what is the problem that we're actually discussing? Because if we are just discussing, if the question is simply how many migrants should come to Australia, then by virtue of that question, you're making, like, that's a question about whether migrants as a whole, an entire group, are good, you know, like the problem is migrants. Whereas if we drill down into the actual problems, like is it causing pressures on the housing market or the jobs or, jobs or arguments that conservatives would make that it's like about safety, or is it an environmental question? Are we literally saying how many migrants can we have until we are physically squeezed in shoulder to shoulder next to each other? Like, what is the actual question that we're asking? Because then I think we can have a sensible discussion about it. But if we're just asking, well, just tell me, you know, out of context, like how many migrants should Australia accept? Like, why? Why are you asking, you know?
Yeah, because it gets really woolly really quickly, because you sort of say, well, we should have a sustainable level of migration.
For what? Sustainable for what, though?
Yeah. Sustainable what? To produce, to have a good quality of life for everyone. Okay.
Yeah, well, and what does that mean? What does that look like?
Yeah, what does that look like? Yeah, so it gets very tricky. Let's lay out some basic numbers at the moment, and I think this might help, you know, highlight why this is sort of entering the political conversation at the moment particularly, and why this issue, I guess, has particular bite or cut through, I suppose. Not that Australia hasn't been very racist and worried about immigration for a very long
Australia's
time.
Australia's become kind of racist lately.
it's a time-honored Australian tradition. So every year the government sets a permanent migration cap that includes family visas and permanent skilled visas. That's often the cap or the number that we're talking about when politicians are talking about the level of migration. Last financial year, the cap was set at 190,000 people. This financial year, it's set to be 185,000 people. On top of the permanent program is our humanitarian program. That's visas for refugees and people seeking asylum. That sits at around 20,000 people per year. And on top of all of that is the uncapped number of temporary visas. That includes short-term skills visas and international students. And recently, in 2022, 2023, there was a big post-pandemic surge. And in fact, the coalition government was doing shitloads of stuff to increase, you know, to get our numbers back as much as possible, doing some pretty wild visa moves in order to do that, to, like, you know, get numbers back up to level after we obviously closed the borders during the pandemic. So that, I think, is why things are getting particularly spicy at the moment. Australia's net overseas migration for 2022-2023, so that's obviously all the people that came in minus all the people that left, was 518,000 people, which is almost twice the typical amount in recent years.
Okay.
The Labor government is saying that number has peaked and it's going to go down to 395,000 next financial year, then 265,000 the year after that.
Meanwhile, in the background, Australia's population is on track to grow to about 40 million people by 2060. I think that's the latest decent projection.
Hang on. So by net, we mean that's the number that have moved here less the number that have moved away?
Yes.
Okay. And that's – so that would then mean that most of that is on temporary visas.
Yes. Yes, but perhaps the focus on the permanent migration cap is that, well, permanent people, obviously, if you're moving here permanently,
yes,
then you are adding pressures on, well, or at least you are, you need a house to live for a long period of time or what have you. You know what I mean.
Mm.
Australia's population is on track to grow to about 40 million people by 2060. That's a projection, not a target, because there is still no actual population policy. Remember back in the Rudd years, it was like, I guess he was talking about a big Australia. There's always this big Australia, small Australia debate, but there's no official population target.
Mm.
And I guess running alongside this is the fact that polls have pretty consistently shown pretty strong support for reduced migration levels. That's quite a popular opinion amongst the Australian public. One poll last year found as many as a quarter of respondents wanted zero net migration. So I guess whoever many people leave is the number of people that come in, one in,
how
one
many,
out. Kind of
can line. I ask, do you know how many leave, like what our net, is it emigration?
I think it's something in the order of 70 to 80,000 off the total top of my head.
Immigration? 70 yes. to 80. Okay.
I right. believe so. And some of these folks that we'll hear from who are advocating a lower migration take say, put the number at something closer to 150,000, which would account for the people that leave, but also would slowly or at least, you know, reduce the amount of population growth, but would still allow for some, I suppose.
Mm.
And I think what's interesting is that often these polling, when you get people say, hey, we should have less migration, you also see generally favorable views of immigration as a concept, that is. And I think that you probably would say that there is a very large number of people who sit in the category of, you know, I think migration is generally good, but I happen to think that right now we've got too many folks coming into the country and we should reduce that amount.
Yep.
And that's when it gets tricky to me, because I'm like, how does your average punter measure that?
Yeah.
Because I think that your average punter, obviously the average people read the news and keep across the stats and all that kind of stuff. But also, you know, this is where it does get a little bit tricky, because you think, oh, is it just the presence of people of color in your neighborhood? Is it you sitting in traffic? Is it like, what are the indicators that people think, oh, there's just too many bloody people around here? And how do people make that decision,
I suppose? I don't know. It's almost, it's funny because, well, this would kind of contradict when we're talking about the idea of migration versus it in reality. But I would think it's more like that. It's like racism and prejudice generally, where people tend to be conservatives or people who have a high level of prejudice are like, don't like the idea of gay marriage, or they don't like the idea of, I don't know, colored like people of color. But then they've got a friend, like, anyone who's actually like that they actually meet, they're like, no, they're good. I don't know. Like, so I guess maybe when it's broken down into what migrants as people actually contribute, then they're like, yeah, that's good. But when they think of just people, like a bunch of faceless, qualityless people coming in, they're like, no, bad.
Well, yes, but also you would have to have some sympathy from, again, this wouldn't be a policy wonk level, but just by the nature of saying, well, more people means has consequences, right? There are impacts of having more people. Now, we know that there are economic benefits to immigration. If you know, more people means that you do grow the economy, so that has benefits as well. And we could grow our economy in a way, or grow our society in a way to meet the demand so that everyone can have a good life, that kind of thing. But I suppose, you know, just on a very basic intuitive level, you say more people means, and more people need more places to live. That's more people on the roads. That's more people using public transport, more people accessing the healthcare system, et cetera, et cetera. Is that fair enough to say?
I mean, capitalism, like our current social structure, is predicated on competition. So it's unsurprising that people would be worried about more people, because that's, quote unquote, more competition.
Right. Now, on that note too, I think the important part of from the left where we're talking about migration is recognizing the political economy of immigration, all right? Obviously, the story that the political class likes to tell us often is that, hey, we're a welcoming country in Australia, we're multicultural, and we just bring people here because we just want to give them a better life. And you go, well, no, the history of immigration throughout Australia's history has been determined by economic forces, and overwhelmingly, you know, capital, big business, and yes, governments
have sought advantage and have needed to fill labor shortages to create more money, to get a better labor force, et cetera, like all those implications that come from immigration. They're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. Overwhelmingly, those big forces, the big migration waves in the 50s and 60s were economic considerations and to meet the demand of capital in a massive continent with a very small population.
Yeah. And that's where, I mean, I guess then the question for leftists is, well, do we agree with those objectives? And so, like, for example, if you look at the Greens policy around migration, a lot of it is more about if people are coming to Australia as, like, to work, for example, what are the conditions under which they're working and how do we treat migrant workers? Like, that then I think is a very worthy question rather, perhaps more a question that I would tend to look at than how many people should we have? Because I think like the fundamental, I guess that's why I'm like, if you break it down into the questions, if you acknowledge that, yes, more people coming equals more pressure on, for example, housing, there is a solution to that though. Like we are able to build more homes and we've shown that we can build more homes and we know that we've got all these developers sitting on land and we know that we've got empty homes and all of that. So it kind of, we take it back to the, like there are solutions, but those are all solutions, as always, that would threaten the power and profits of the political of capital of capitalist and corporate profits. And so the easier answer is just cap migration levels. But it is, as you say, it's an intuitive answer.
Yes. But I suppose also it is, you know, there's a big wing of capital, of big business, who want migration levels to stay where they are or increase, right?
I mean,
and people have pointed out the irony of the Howard years when he's, of course, tough on borders, demonizing refugees, you know, saying strong borders, we decide who comes here. At the same time, his government was massively increasing the migration program, often to the pleasure of capital, right? Because they wanted more workers. They wanted that to, well, yes, undermine the conditions of existing workers and such. So I guess, I see where you're coming from now. The response is to say, well, you know, if a world in which it doesn't matter about your migration status, depending on the rights that you get as a worker, then that would not be, that would not have the same advantage for capital. Is that fair to say?
And that's exactly like, and I think that as the fact that along parallel tracks, supporters of capitalism and conservatives will argue for less migration and more migration proves that because whichever way it is for them, they will make it work in their favor. And that's why I think that like if we were to make a demand for if we were to reduce migration for the objective of improving access to housing or because we were like, well, workers don't have access to adequate rights or whatever it was, we know, though, that without changing the underlying structures, those things wouldn't improve because, for example, developers would just land bank more because they need to hold back a certain portion of supply. They need to hold back supply in order to increase demand and drive up prices. Or, you know, capitalists or employers are always going to cut costs as much as they possibly can in order to drive up profits for them. So I think that's where it's like, migration actually isn't the question that's going to solve those problems so long as those people are in power.
Right. Private property developers don't give a shit about your migration status. If you buy the house or if you pay your rent or whatever, like that's what they're concerned. If you could pay the most amount of money, if you're more desperate, in fact, because of your migration status, then that's good for them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into that because obviously housing is the focus of the coalition's policy on this particular front. That's why they want to talk about migration levels. This is their big solution to the housing crisis, of course, is cutting migration. In his budget reply speech last week, Peter Dutton called for a cut in the permanent visas cap to 140,000 for 2 years, then 150,000 in year three, and 160,000 the year after that. He also wants to slash our refugee intake, which is insane. Our refugee intake is already very miserly. There's an increased need for people needing safety and shelter across the world with more crises kicking on and with climate change, that'll get worse. And he said a coalition government would impose a 2-year ban on foreign investors and temporary residents buying homes. Dutton said this would free up almost 40,000 additional homes in the first year and well over 100,000 homes in the next 5 years.
So simple.
Very simple. Now, there was a bit of business. Angus Taylor, also the Shadow Treasurer, did a speech at the National Press Club this week, and there was a bit of coverage about him fucking up the numbers and they're different to what Dutton said. I don't think it's actually that big a story. I think he's probably maybe fluffed out on the day, but the policy is still basically the same.
He's saying that these new homes are going to be built, but there's not going to be as many people to move into them. So that's how they're freed up. But again, it's like, but are they going to be built? Are they going to be built if that's going to mean that maybe house prices go down? Like, because supply is actually meeting demand. How's that going to work when we've got a housing system that is like predicated on profit and commodification, you know?
Certainly. But yes, again, Taylor saying we think we can achieve a net migration in Australia, which is consistent with the level of housing supply that is realistic. You cannot move housing supply overnight, so you need to bring those two numbers into line. So again, I mean, that this is the response, again, predicated on the belief that there are just property developers out there who just want to build as many homes as possible. They just want to house people as many as humanly possible. That's just their dream. That's what they want to do. And the only thing holding them back, I suppose, is bloody greens on local councils, I suppose. But I suppose, again, that might be intuitively correct too. The idea that, well, okay, the whole system's fucked. We can't build shitloads of homes overnight. We can't move housing supply overnight, as Angus Taylor might say. So the thing that we can adjust is the number of people coming into the country to reduce the population, which would have some impact, he would argue, on the demand for housing. Is that
sure? If supply and demand were the only issues at play in the housing market, but we know they're not.
On the housing Q&A episode that we talked about in that live app with Max earlier in the year, Liberal Senator Andrew Bragg said, "In the last year, we've had 670,000 new migrants come in and only 170,000 houses being built." Now, again, that 660,000 figure ignores net migration, so ignores people leaving as well, which you think would be relevant. But again, they're clearly using this line. We had Shadow Immigration Minister Dan Tehan saying the record number of people are causing housing crisis. They're causing a rental crisis. I mean, this is the line from the coalition, right?
Yeah.
We've got to cut migration because that's the thing.
Yeah.
And I think this is where it gets really, sinister and xenophobic, right? All my caveats, my interest in this topic and my belief that we can have a conversation about migration numbers aside, the idea that you are centering your housing policy, your response to the housing crisis is cutting migration, like that is crazy. And that is actually scapegoating and blaming people trying to come here for systematic failures that have been here for decades and decades and decades.
It's scapegoating, and it's also awfully convenient if you want to abrogate your responsibility for providing public infrastructure like housing. You know, it brings to mind, I don't know if you saw, but this week the Labor Premier in Queensland, Stephen Miles, is actually also taking this line, particularly when it comes to like road infrastructure. He came out and said that, oh, migrants are making traffic worse effectively. He said, we've had all of this migration into Queensland and that's why traffic is so bad, etc. And the deepest irony is that News Corp papers then come out and, of course, slam him because he's a Labor Premier, saying, oh, you're blaming migration for your government's failures to build enough roads, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, how do you not see that when that happens, when your mates say it and you say you blame migrants for the housing crisis? But of course, they can see it so plainly there that this is a government trying to not take responsibility for their failure to, I don't know, you know, build enough public transport, for example, or increase access to public transport to make our public infrastructure work for everyone. Instead, they just say, oh, it's the migrants' fault, so we don't have to do anything about it. Like, I think that is also insidious, obviously, that the scapegoating and the xenophobia is insidious too, but yeah.
Well, it's interesting too, once you dig into the numbers a little bit too, you sort of say, well, there's a lot of doubt over this premise generally, right? I found an article at australianpropertyupdate.com.au, which I very rarely go to, but an article called "Are Migrants to Blame for Australia's Housing Crisis?" by Scott Kuru. And he talks to this guy, Simon Presley, who's the head of research at buyer's agency Propertology. Now, we don't like Propertology, and you'll find out why, but Simon Presley has some interesting takes here. Despite the factually incorrect statements from various economists and other general gum flappers, existing Australians, not new arrivals, are the ones driving competition to buy and to rent real estate. Simon Presley says that overseas migration added a net annual average of around 200,000 people to Australia's population over the last decade. He claims this only created demand for 60,000 extra homes over that time. I assume that's total over the whole decade, I suppose.
Okay.
So he's sort of casting some doubt on this massive demand side
question. He also highlights the contrast between migration patterns and house values. Over the last 22 years, he says overseas migration added a net 22% to the population of New South Wales, while house prices in that state's largest city, Sydney, increased by 270%. Similar vibe in Victoria, 25% of the population, Melbourne house prices have soared 274%. Again, saying that there is clearly something else going on here that we need to talk about.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I would even take a critical eye to that, but it is sort of like, is anyone really arguing that the housing prices would raise on the exact same percentage?
Not exact same, but I suppose the lack really of correlation, you know, the huge disparate nature between those
obviously
two figures.
Obviously something else is happening, yes.
There's something else going on, yes. Simon Presley also references census data about the time overseas migrants take before buying a home. 70% of migrants take 10 or more years to purchase a home, whereas data analysis for the decade ending March 2023 confirms that of the 493,232 average annual volume of properties purchased in Australia, recent arrivals bought just 7% of them.
Mm-hmm.
He also claims it's 3% of rental tenancy movements each year are created by overseas migrants. So they're also pointing out the fact that migrants overwhelmingly rent more than get involved in the property market too.
Mm, yeah.
Okay, so here's Simon Presley's final fit, which makes you go, uh-oh, maybe Simon Presley's got some issues. Anyone who believes overseas migration is to blame for Australia's rental crisis is a bigot, all right? But that's where he parts company with the community, ethnic and social service groups who claim migrants have been unfairly blamed for the housing shortage. Mr. Presley blames a series of policies or threatened policies by politicians and bankers since 2014, which he says have helped create Australia's current rental crisis by discouraging property investors.
Yes.
Okay. This included credit squeeze, the foreign investor surcharge, state law reforms that have increased tenant rights. You know all those tenant rights that we have in Australia? Bill Shorten's election pledges to curb negative gearing.
Right.
The COVID-19 eviction moratorium, calls for rent freezes. Hello, that's us.
Eviction
and
moratorium.
State land tax increases.
The eviction moratorium, wow. People rarely go as far to criticise that one. That's and it's funny as well. Yes, like, are we talking about ownership, like getting people to own their own home, or are we talking about rental affordability where maybe inflating things? There's another question, maybe separate to migration, though, about like foreign ownership of property that I think is sometimes even conflated because people are like, we're talking about xenophobia and the housing market. And what am I not allowed to point out that, you know, all of these Chinese investors are buying up property, for example, and people who live in Australia can't get access. But again, it's like, well, that is not about the fact that they're not Australian.
No.
Really, the issue is that
we
have...
I hate all investors. I don't see colour when it comes to investors.
Colorblind, yes.
So this Chinese investor shouldn't buy a property. Should an Australian investor
buy
it?
But an Australian investor should.
Is that what
you're exactly.
saying?
And that's where you can always... You like, if you drill down into it and you're like, so do you support dismantling the tax incentives
yes.
that like... push that make it easier for an investor to buy their sixth home than it is for a first home buyer to get into the market. Like, and if they're like, oh, well, no, maybe not, then yes, it is purely racism. But if you do have a criticism of the way that our housing system is stacked in favor of commodification and investment, then sure, like, let's take it on board.
I mean, again, which, make a great point. And I think Max is constantly trying to do this, is the battle over the emphasis or the main drivers, the primary drivers when it comes to a housing crisis. So, yes, at the edges, as Max has said, you know, planning considerations are a factor, I guess, when it comes to the way that we're building and planning our cities. Sure. But the distraction, the way that people want to point to that issue or to migration as the primary consideration, or this is our flagship policy to address the housing crisis, and ignoring the obvious drivers of like tax incentives and this commodification of housing and the influx of property investors. It is a kind of sneaky trick, right? Is to, hey, look over here. Look over here. Blame these people. They're your problem.
Yeah.
Now, having said all that, can we say there's a meaningful difference between blaming migrants for causing the housing crisis, which we should not do, that's bullshit and racist, and recognizing the relationship between the size of our population and the housing market and our ability to provide decent housing for everyone?
I just say that
thinking of like, well, look at the difference between house prices in cities and regional areas. Okay, like clearly the number of people that you have has an effect on people's ability to, or the housing market, you know, it is a factor in that affects housing prices. So isn't that reasonable to sort of say that there is some relationship there in some way?
sure. But for me, I don't really, I'm more interested in the then what, you know, because are we saying that, okay, and so we limit migration to this level, and then that means we need to deliver this many homes. Like that's an important discussion. Then how do we deliver those homes? Who delivers them? Yeah. Who are they owned by? How can people get access to them? How much they cost, et cetera. That's the interesting conversation. If we are saying we're not going to limit migration at all, or we're going to increase migration, again, yes, I think then the question is, okay, how many homes does that mean that we need? How are we going to deliver them? Who's going to own them? How do people get access to them? Like, those are the questions that I am interested in. I don't really, yeah, I'm like, sure, of course, more people need homes. Everyone needs a home. Mm. But I don't think that that is the controversial question.
Yeah, interesting. And yeah, I think I wonder whether population policies, because my other thing when I think about this is like, I mean, a massive problem we have is the fact that, okay, whatever your migration levels, overwhelmingly large proportions of migrants are going to want to live in cities, okay? And that's completely understandable. There's economic reasons for that. There's cultural reasons for that. You know, that's where they'll find themselves. I mean, we do have a pretty shitty process. Obviously, there are incentives that encourage people to try and spend 2 years in a regional center or whatever. Like, obviously, yeah. like governments try to do that stuff.
Yeah.
But that clearly just isn't working. And that goes to other questions about investment in regional areas and infrastructure, all the same stuff that we're talking about, bonging in about democratic social as democratic socialists all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd say that Labor kind of wants it both ways on this stuff. Jim Chalmers on Insiders last week was sort of saying,
wanting it both ways?
Yeah, weird. They were like, Dutton's ridiculous and he's pulling these numbers out of nowhere and this is going to make a marginal difference on the housing situation and on the economy. But also we're doing it. We are reducing numbers.
Beach and it's all fold. Totally fine.
So that's good that we're doing it. But when he talks about doing it, then it's actually bad.
Yeah.
So again, trying to have it both ways.
Yeah.
Again, I've still got just like questions here. It's been helpful talking through
just
this with you.
Just asking questions.
Thinking about it, but just asking questions. Is that so wrong? And I suppose, you know, my other question is like, what is the Greens' position on this? And look, I'll be honest, I've only sort of skimmed through these very quickly, but there's the population policy and the immigration and refugees policy on the Greens' website. And I would say overwhelmingly, the immigration and refugee policy is about human rights and people being treated with dignity, which is all very good and important, and full credit to the Greens for doing that. But there is not like a number here. I don't think there is a position necessarily on whether we should have more or less migration. Perhaps expecting that to be there is unrealistic. Maybe the major parties don't have that either. Mm. But I suppose if you're a Greens MP out there and you're in the media and this debate is raging around you and you're asked a simple question or something like, do you think Australia's migration is too high or too low? What do you think they'd say? What should they say? Do we care about that particular position? What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, what should they say? Like, what I would say today is that under our current, like, economic system and the government's failure to invest in infrastructure, it's too high because of the government's failure.
Right.
The level in isolation is not too high. I mean, I was just thinking about what I just said in terms of set a target or don't set a target and then plan for that. Maybe it should be the other way around. Maybe it's, you know, we look at the resources that we have as a country, and if we were to run it right and actually prioritize social housing and public infrastructure and you know, tax big corporations and all the things that the Greens say we want to do, how much resources, how much infrastructure, housing, et cetera, could we then produce? And that's how you would figure out what a quote-unquote sustainable level of migration is, and perhaps then you could set a cap if you need to. But I suspect, and I think this is why ultimately a lot of Greens shy away from the question of a cap, because ultimately I think a lot of us believe, and I guess I don't ultimately know, but I think I do believe that if we did that, we wouldn't need to set a cap.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess I just find my thinking coming back to the fact that there is a number, right? The government does set a number. And I suppose my question is, who determines that number? And we shouldn't be naive enough to think that the government think, let's set a number that's the best for everyone, the best for people who are here and the best for migrants. No. We know that's not true, right? We know there are economic and political forces that have an influence and have very strong opinions and have interests tied up with what that number is.
Tom, you know how they probably set the number is just based on how many applications they can process with their limited staff in their visa officers.
Interesting.
Like, I don't know. I mean, could it be as ridiculous as that?
As that. This is the number one that we get through. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there is some stuff on the Greens policy position about, you know, stuff around meeting skill shortages. One of the things that they're calling for, a review of the family skilled and business migration streams to prioritise family reunion and meeting skills shortages as well. So there's also, you know, a recognition of the relationship between immigration and skills in the labour force, skilled migration programs that do not substitute for training or undermine wages and conditions in Australia, which is also...
Recognising qualifications would help. Like, isn't there that classic thing of, you know, someone being way overqualified, moving to Australia and us being like, oh, no, no, no. Your degree can possibly, yes, you'll be driving Uber. Yeah.
You need to pay us hundreds of thousands of dollars to train at our incredible
and our private universities to get your degree again. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, look, I'm sure people listening have strong opinions about this, and maybe I've said terrible things in the course of this and you'll cancel me or whatever, but get in touch.
I'd like,
I think this conversation is not going anywhere. I think that it's highly likely that at the upcoming election, I mean, obviously the coalition is putting that front and center and want to have that debate over migration levels. And I just think it's important that we think about it and think more deeply and have a good, non-racist, nice,
Tom,
realistic response.
Tom thinks the show name relates to migrants.
I just don't like how they're different to me.
It's a real serious danger to Australia.
Only the Conservative Party can stand for freedom and sort out the problems that we face.
What do you want to do if you're not an MP?
Skydiving, motorcycling, fast catamaran sailing.
And I did a couple of laps, I pulled over. The bloke that runs the thing came over and said, "Oi, no professionals." I took my helmet off, I said, "I'm not a professional." He said, "You're not a professional." I said, "No." He said, "Well, you should be. If I was you, I'd take up Formula One. If you drive like that, you'd probably be the best in the country." So I'm not interested in making shitloads out of
skydiving, motorcycling, fast catamaran sailing.
Tom, what should people do this week if they would like to take action for a better world?
Oh, wow. Great question, Emerald. Thank you so much for asking this.
No worries.
I would suggest, if you haven't already, check out assangecampaign.org.au. We had the decision this week that Julian Assange has won the right to appeal his decision to be extradited to the US, where he'll be put into a blender by the CIA or something. I don't know. It's good news that hopefully there's a chance that the UK might not extradite him. And my understanding is from the Assange campaign is now, as ever, is a good time to remind our political class, put political pressure on our leaders to make it very clear that Australia supports the idea of Julian Assange not being put in that blender, not being extradited to the US, where he may very well face the death penalty, or at least will be detained for the rest of his life or whatever. Because he did a good thing, which was expose war crimes. And it's important, if you believe in journalists being able to do that, that he not be punished in the way that is proposed. So assangecampaign.org.au, if you get a chance and find out what they're doing, you can write letters, you can sign petitions, you can add to the millions of voices around the world who are supporting Julian at the moment.
So true. The other thing you can do that I'm going to jump in as a Queensland Green, as a Greenslander right now, is just shamelessly say, please give us money. If you have any spare money, please donate to the Queensland Greens. I'm just going to say it. We need money. We really do. We don't have lots. And we have three federal MPs. There's going to be an election before we know it. And I would say, as someone here in Queensland, I am seeing how much money the other parties have. And I'm scared, because we love our MPs and we need them to stay, and it takes a lot of fucking money to win and to keep a seat. We have our state election coming up as well, where we're trying to win, and it's essential that we do well in that election in order to keep those seats. Like, that's a big part of it. So I know that I think there's less money kicking around these days. Someone's got to do something about this. I hear that things are rough. But seriously, even if you just have a little bit of money and you like the work that, you know, Stephen, Libby and Max do in Parliament, and also the work that we're doing in Queensland State Parliament, please donate. Please give us money. I'll put a link in the show notes. Thank you.
Have they pre-selected candidates for anything? Like, is there a Labor Griffith candidate? Do they exist?
I heard... talk.
Is Terry coming back?
No, I don't think Terry. I don't know. No, maybe not Griffith. I'm not sure. Not sure.
Interesting. Money to all the billionaires listening, please give the Greens some money. Thanks.
Yes.
Hey, while you're on the internet, you can rate, review our show at Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening now. You can follow us on socials at SeriousDangerAU. Send us an email anytime. hello@seriousdangerpod.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts on migration, etc. And we will catch you next week. We love you. Goodbye.
We love you heaps. I love you more than Tom loves you.
What?
Maybe.
Serious Danger, Australia.